In recent years, genetic genealogy has become a somewhat surprising new tool in the arsenal of police investigators as it has helped them to catch a variety of different criminals through use of things like DNA kits. These kits were previously designed to create family trees for people, but now that they're being used to investigate homicides, it means many serial killers have been caught before their victim list can swell to include larger and larger numbers. Of course, most killers are still able to roam free during the early days of their sprees by hiding in plain sight, meaning it remains common for them to stack up body counts in the multiples before they're eventually captured. And that's exactly what happened during the 2000s and 2010s with a man who by all accounts appeared to be relatively normal and well-rounded to those who knew him. Unfortunately, like many serial killers, his outside appearance was only a facade to hide the evil that was truly inside him. This is Monsters. Robert Tyrone Hayes was born on March 12, 1982 in West Palm Beach, Florida, and it was there he was mostly raised by his mother after his father was murdered shortly after his birth. Unfortunately, it seems that murder had a crippling emotional effect on the widow as, growing up, Robert would be repeatedly abused by his mother. It's not clear what the exact abuse was, but it's likely it involved some kind of sexual acts. And if that was the case, it wouldn't be the only time the youngster was molested as a child, because while he was still a teenager, a separate family member would also force him into a sexual situation against his will. Needless to say then, those incidents had a big impact on the man Robert would later become. And it wasn't just the sexual abuse that negatively affected him either, as during his school years he'd be a regular target for bullies on account of him being overweight. Still though, while all that might have been quietly combining inside of him to create a whirlwind of pain and anger, to the outside world he seemed to be an altogether normal kid. In fact, friends and family would often describe him as someone who'd be there for you if you ever needed him. After all, he was friendly, loving, good-humored, and cared a lot for anyone he was close to, including his three older siblings. On top of that, Squeaky, as he was nicknamed by his peers, was very outspoken when it came to speaking up about any wrongdoings he'd witnessed, so it was no surprise he was so beloved by his inner circle. Of course, few knew about what he'd gone through during his childhood. All they knew was that he was a boy with a lot of ambition, someone whose love of poetry was only matched by his desire to learn as much as he could about the criminal justice system, with his reasoning for that being that he could then use that knowledge to help out others. After graduating from school in 2000, Robert had even enrolled himself at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach, where he majored in criminal justice. It was while studying there that he also got involved in a number of other extracurricular activities, such as cheerleading. That said, his most popular pastime of all appeared to be sex. By the time he had reached adulthood, Robert had a very active sex life, with that being something that was known to those around him. It wasn't uncommon for him to attend sex parties in the area or for him to meet up with sex workers, and at one point he even invited a family member of his to join him at one of those parties. Still, while that may have seemed a little unusual to most, the people around him largely treated it as not a big deal. After all, Robert wasn't doing anything wrong. He was just exploring his sexuality in a way which fitted him. It wasn't as if that was stopping him from engaging in more traditional romantic relationships, as during at least a period of the time he spent studying at Bethune-Cookman University, he had a somewhat serious girlfriend. At one point, he and that woman even had a child together, but it doesn't look like that child or the woman he had the baby with stayed in his life over the long term, as by the point he was approaching the end of his studies in the mid-2000s, there's no evidence to suggest he still had any contact with them. No, it looked like he was flying solo once more, and that meant he felt like he was free to go and explore any passion he wanted, with at least one of those passions being that he had become interested in starting a cooking business. At some point, Robert had become very interested in the culinary arts, and so had decided that was an industry he wanted to get involved in. Unfortunately, though, it appears he never managed to open his business, with the closest he got being to work as a cook for a while. And it's perhaps that which led to some of those old angry feelings arising within him once again. Sure, he still had a good life by the accounts of most. He had good friends, an active sex life, and was on the verge of obtaining a hard-earned degree in criminal justice. But clearly there was still something missing for the man who would later go on to be known as the Daytona Beach Killer. Is that why he started doing things that got him in trouble with the law then? Things like engaging in petty theft and disorderly conduct? Possibly, but luckily for him, both of those incidents wouldn't lead to many problems, as the charges would be dropped before they could ever go to court. That perhaps spurred him on to thinking he could get away with even greater crimes, which may have been how we got to a situation where, in December of 2005, mere months before he was set to graduate, he killed his first victim. Of course, no one knew it was him who had done it at the time. All police knew was that on December 26th of that year, a 45-year-old woman named Laketta Mae Gunther had turned up dead in an alley near her home. How had she gotten there? Well, 2 days prior to that, on Christmas Eve, after making plans to go to dinner with her friend Stacy Dittmer, she went missing while out working in the sex trade. Yes, Laketta was a sex worker, and that was almost certainly how she came into contact with Robert Hayes, as it was already known by then that he was a frequenter of such businesses. And while it's not clear exactly how their encounter went down, it's not hard to infer that after paying her and taking her to a quieter location under the guise of having sex with her there, Robert proceeded to take out his frustrations on her, killing her in the process with a single gunshot wound to the head. Really, it was all too easy for him to get away with this crime because, as history has shown, the disappearances of sex workers are often not treated as high priority by the police. That's probably why, when Laketta's friend Stacy reported her missing after she didn't show up for dinner that night, it took 2 days for her body to be discovered. So, now with one murder under his belt and a sense that he'd likely never be caught for it, Robert probably felt emboldened to continue down that path as, just a few weeks later, he struck again. And that time, his victim was another local sex worker, a 34-year-old woman named Julie Green. Like with Laketta Gunther, when police found Julie's body on January 14th, there was a gunshot wound in the back of her head, suggesting the murder had been carried out execution style. But for as much as that clearly pointed towards there being a killer out there, the investigation team could find no DNA evidence at the scene that might help them identify the perpetrator. All they had to go on were tire tracks located near the body, with those tracks coming from either a 2003 Ford Taurus or Mercury Sable. While they had initially hoped that might eventually prove a lead on who had carried out such a horrific act, those tire tracks would ultimately lead nowhere. So at that point, powerless to do anything about what had happened, all the police could do was wait and see if the killer struck again, something he did just over 1 month later. That's right, it was on February 24th, 2006, my 29th birthday, that the body of 35-year-old nurse's aide, Iwana Patton, was discovered after an anonymous tip had led police to the site of her murder. No prizes for guessing that Iwana was also a sex worker and that she had also been killed by a single gunshot wound to the head. In her case, however, the wound was not in the back of her head, but rather in the front, with the reason for that likely being that she'd realized what was happening before the shot could come and had attempted to fight off her killer before he eventually got the better of her. Of course, that detail only served to scare the public even more, as now it became clear to them that a serial killer was on the loose. After all, the similarities between that murder and the prior two murders were too obvious for it to not be the work of the same person. And those fears would only be further heightened when it became apparent the authorities were struggling to find a culprit to pin the crimes on. Sure, they'd been able to find DNA evidence at the scene where they'd discovered Iwana Patton's body, and they'd also been able to locate shell casings which suggested the murder weapon had been a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson Sigma Series VE pistol, but even that wasn't enough for them to locate a prime suspect during the interview process that followed. Despite speaking to a number of people at the time, including Robert as it happened, none of the interviews bore enough fruit to leave them feeling like they had the person responsible. Rather, all it made them feel like was that they were quickly sinking when it came to solving the case before the killer could strike again. Outside of that one piece of DNA evidence and the detail about the make of the gun used in the murders, all they had to go on was theory and speculation, with their best ideas at that point being that whoever was responsible was probably a white male either working alone or with a female partner whom he resented, and that he was using his victims as a means of taking out that resentment. Of course, they weren't the only ones who were coming up with theories at that point, though, as, now in something of a panic themselves, the people of Florida began speculating on who the killer might be, too. As some saw it, the person now branded the Daytona Beach killer by the media was probably a truck driver, as that would allow him to stalk his victims without suspicion. Meanwhile, others argued that it had to have been a member of the armed forces or the police themselves who was behind the murder, as that would explain how they were able to evade capture so easily. Others still, though, well, they believed it had to be someone who had a vendetta against sex workers because, as the media had taken such special attention to focus on, it had been those people who had died in each instance, something that understandably terrified the local sex work community so much that they'd now taken to memorizing license plates and vehicle descriptions of any clients they had in case they needed to recall them again in the future. But none of those public-led theories would prove to be the truth in the end. No, the truth was that Robert Hayes was a relatively unassuming person who had never worked in either the military, law enforcement, or as a truck driver. Rather, he had spent most of his time working as a cook post-graduation, with that perhaps being an added frustration for him on account of the degree he held. The only real trouble he'd found himself in since leaving Bethune-Cookman University was being arrested on charges of driving without a valid license, as his had expired in 2007. So it wasn't as if he had a past prior criminal record that might give him away. And that's probably a large part of the reason he was so easily dismissed as a suspect when he was first interviewed during the initial part of the investigation. It didn't matter that records showed he'd bought a .40 caliber gun just like the one used to kill Laketa Gunther, Julie Green, and Iwana Patton only months before the first body was discovered. That in itself was purely circumstantial, and once investigators got talking to him about it, they had no reason to not believe his story that it had been purchased as a gift for his mother. But then, maybe they were predisposed to believing that story because, as far as the criminal profile they had of the mystery man told them, they were looking for a white man while Robert himself was black. Either way, after a short conversation about the murders, they decided not to investigate him any further. In the words of Daytona Beach Police Chief Craig Capri when later asked about that decision following his eventual capture, quote, "His name did pop up earlier in the investigation, but we didn't have enough evidence to think he was even linked to it. There were so many people interviewed. We interviewed hundreds of people, and he was one of them." Of course, none of the people who were interviewed ended up being charged with the triple murder, though, as none of them had done it. The decision to focus primarily on Caucasian suspects proved to be a mistake in the long run, as it led to the actual killer slipping through the police's fingers and having plenty of time to go on and kill again. And as a side note, statistically, serial killers like this do tend to be white males, so I don't feel like this is a huge failure on the part of the police. They were just going off of information given to them by a criminal profiler, and historically those profiles tend to be fairly accurate. Though they shouldn't have eliminated anybody that didn't perfectly fit the profile, because the profiles can be wrong. After waiting a little while in order to presumably let the heat die down, Robert found his fourth victim on December 11, 2007, in the form of 30-year-old Stacy Charlene Gage. Stacy, who lived with her grandmother and young child, had left home that evening in order to get in her van and go to the store to buy a bag of ice. Somewhere along the way, though, she evidently crossed paths with Robert, and it would prove to be fatal. Now, given the fact she wasn't an active sex worker, she didn't fit the bill of what the killer had been looking for prior to that. But she did have a prior history in the sex trade, so it's possible he mistakenly thought that she was working and tried to proposition her before taking her life. It is also known she was a drug user and had a past record for various minor offenses, with Corporal Gina Baker of the Holly Hill Police Department later describing knowing Stacy as such. She said, quote, "It was almost like a roller coaster ride with her. I'd last seen her in November and it appeared that she was using drugs again. She was going down that spiral again." So perhaps in her spiral, she had tried to buy some drugs from Robert on the night of her death, thinking that he was a dealer. Perhaps she even offered him sex in exchange, only for him to get angry about it and kill her in a fit of rage. Of course, it should be noted this is all pure speculation, as Robert has refused to speak on the matter in the years since, so the true details of what occurred between the two may never be known. But it's still a somewhat reasonable assumption to come to regardless based on the evidence we have. At the end of the day, all that matters is the result, with that being that before the night was over, Stacy Gage would be dead of a gunshot wound to the head. Not that anyone would find her body right away, though. No, it would take almost a full month, up until January 2, 2009, before someone spotted her body lying on a secluded road not far from her home. As to what became of her van, well, that would later be found in the parking lot of a nearby apartment complex, suggesting the killer had dumped it there after getting rid of her body. And given how similar the whole situation was to the prior three murders, it didn't take long for police to put two and two together and determine it was the work of the same killer. Obviously, that reignited the local public's fear over a murderer being in their midst as, after a period where it looked like things may have calmed down, the deaths had returned with a vengeance. And they weren't the only ones who were scared now, because the police themselves, realizing how little headway they'd made before, now understood the heavy weight of the task ahead of them. As then Daytona Police Chief Mike Chitwood would put it when asked to make a statement following the discovery of Stacy Gage's body, quote, "It makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you look at the victimology, at Stacy's past, the topography of where the bodies were found, and obviously other signs and clues at the crime scene. You begin to think, wow, we're heading down this road again?" Yes, it was an intimidating conclusion to come to, no doubt, but one that could not be denied. After all, the murder of Stacy had been eerily similar to that of Laketta, Julie, and Iwana. And while he wouldn't go into much detail about what those similarities were, partially out of respect to the dead, and partially as it was still an ongoing investigation, Mike Chitwood would reveal a few key pieces of information to the public, such as the aforementioned fact that all four had a history of sex work and had been shot in the head, and then had been dumped naked in relatively secluded areas of the city. Not too secluded, though. Whoever the killer was, they either wanted to display their work or had no fear of being caught because there was no attempt to get rid of the bodies after the fact. Instead, they were just dumped in a location where it was inevitable someone was going to find them eventually. So, feeling him gloating at them then, Daytona Beach Police set up a formal task force at that point. The task force would include four detectives working the case full-time, as well as a number of other agents from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement who regularly added input of their own. The only problem with that, however, was that they were still working from a flawed profile, as back in 2008, it had told them that it was a white man they were looking for, one who had a girlfriend that was potentially acting alongside him. So when they went around the local area taking DNA samples from any motorist who fit the bill, they were only wasting their time as it was never going to lead them to the killer. Unsurprisingly then, the killer was never caught, and over the next 8 years, the whole thing basically fell into the realm of being a cold case. That was until March 7th, 2016, as it was then that the moment law enforcement feared would happen finally did. Another body turned up dead by the side of a highway near Jupiter, Florida. That victim was 32-year-old Rachel Elizabeth Bay, someone who also worked as a sex worker around the Florida area and was discovered by a road crew worker in the early hours of the morning that day. She'd last been seen by a friend in West Palm Beach a few days prior with her cell phone in her hand. But while that phone was not on her person at the time of her discovery, it would remain active for a while thereafter, with evidence that was pulled from it remotely suggesting it was somewhere in the West Palm Beach area, the very same area where Robert lived, not that police realized that at the time. And even if they had, Rachel hadn't been killed in the same manner as the prior four victims, as she'd been badly beaten and strangled rather than shot. Then, when he was done, Robert threw her body 50 feet or more than 15 meters off the Beeline Highway to the ground below. So at least initially, police were left wondering if it was the work of someone entirely different. But once a DNA sample found on Rachel's arm was matched to DNA from the scenes of Laketta, Julie, Awana, and Stacy, it became all too clear. The Daytona Beach killer had indeed returned. In his return, he appeared to have evolved, or devolved, depending on the way you chose to look at it, to even more gruesome methods of killing, because, as previously mentioned, it wasn't a simple gunshot wound to the head. No, it was a savage attack which had left the victim with a broken jaw and shattered teeth. By the looks of things, she'd tried to fight her attacker off initially, but, like with Stacy Gage before her, she had ultimately succumbed to him. Obviously, then, that created a renewed urgency to catch the killer. So it's just as well police had developed a new weapon in their arsenal to help them do so by that point, genetic genealogy. Basically, genetic genealogy was something which had started to become commonplace within the general public during the mid-2010s with the rise of companies like 23andMe. But while for most it was just a fun exercise, a way of tracing back your family tree to see how much of each different culture you had in your ancestry, or even to see which illnesses you might be prone to in the future as a means of health preservation, for law enforcement, it soon became clear it could be used to track down killers based on DNA evidence. In short, the whole thing may be best described by Lori Napolitano, genetic genealogy consultant and coach for DNA Family Connections. She says, quote, "Genetic genealogy provides leads to investigations based on DNA matches to relatives found in genealogy databases. Investigators uploaded the crime scene DNA profile of the suspect and received a list of matches. Those matches are people who share DNA with the suspect. The more DNA they share, the more closely they're related." That really became a tool the authorities could use in cases following the trial of William Earl Talbot in the spring of 2016, as it was there, using said genetic genealogy, that prosecutors were able to narrow down a list of suspects and use the evidence they gathered to prove Talbot had killed a young couple in 1987. You can check out my video about that case, there's a link in the description. So with that absolutely changing the game for what was possible in terms of securing a guilty verdict, the investigators working the Daytona Beach killer case didn't waste any time in using it on the DNA evidence they had on file for their mystery man. And when they fed the information into the system, it worked through a vast network of people all before returning with one name, Robert Hayes. Of course, that was puzzling to investigators as they'd already interviewed Robert regarding his potential involvement with the crimes years prior and found him to have no obvious connection. In fact, to them, he felt like the furthest thing in the world from a killer as he appeared to be an altogether well-rounded man, someone who, as mentioned earlier, was well-liked by those around him. But the DNA evidence was what it was, and because of that, they chose to start surveilling Robert at that point, all in the hopes they could get something from him directly which would prove once and for all he was the man they were looking for. That was what led to the events of September 13, 2016, the day the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office's Fugitive Task Force witnessed their prime suspect smoking a cigarette while waiting for a bus near his home. Obviously, before he could get on the bus, he had to discard the butt of his cigarette. Once he'd done so and was being driven away, investigators swooped in and picked it up before it could be compromised in any way. What they were looking for was a DNA sample which matched the one they'd found at the scenes of the murders. If they could obtain that, then there would be little doubt that he was indeed the Daytona Beach killer. And as it happened, they found just that, with the evidence directly linking the West Palm Beach native to not only the murders of Laketta Gunther and Julie Green, but also the more recent killing of Stacy Gage and Rachel Bay, too. Sure, there would be no direct DNA evidence linking Robert to the killing of Awana Patton, but given the similarity between what had happened to her and the other four victims, particularly the first two, investigators felt confident he'd been the man behind that crime as well. And that's how, on September 15, 2019, authorities arrested the Daytona Beach killer at his home in West Palm Beach, Florida. Initially, he was only charged with the murder of Rachel Bay, with authorities having this to say on the matter at a press conference held later that day. Quote, "On Saturday, September 14, 2019, DNA analysis was completed by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Forensic Biology Unit. The results were as followed. The observed DNA profile is greater than 700 billion times more likely to occur if the sample originated from Robert Tyrone Hayes than from an unrelated individual. When asked about how they felt about making the mistake of letting Robert slip through their fingers after they'd first questioned him back in 2006, they stated, quote, "As the years go by, one thing we do in law enforcement, we just don't come to an end and say, okay, the case is over. We continue to work and work and work, utilizing DNA and other technology to try to solve every open case and get closure for the victims and the victims' family members." After that, while addressing the brothers of Rachel Bay specifically, who were in attendance at the press conference, they added to that sentiment by telling them, quote, "The team that you are looking at here will never, ever give up. I don't care if it's 1 year, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we will keep working every single day. Every single hour until we find these monsters who are out here who do these things. Because I can tell you folks, if we hadn't put this individual in jail, he would have done this again and we'd have another innocent victim out there." Yes, while there had clearly been a major mistake made in not arresting the killer back during his early days, at least things had been somewhat rectified now as he was in custody and unable to hurt anyone else. And Lori Napolitano, the head of the genetic genealogy team who had helped to catch Robert, also felt good about finally giving the victim's family some sense of resolution as well, something that was apparent in her own statement at the same press conference. She said, quote, "I would like to extend our condolences to the family of Rachel Bay. Please know we worked countless hours on her case to bring it to resolution and to give Rachel the voice she lost." But were these the only killings Robert Hayes had been involved in? After all, with there being such a gap between his fourth and fifth victims, it was reasonable to believe there were other bodies out there that were yet to be discovered. In fact, some actually posited that there were at least three other deaths attributed to the Daytona Beach killer, with those being 48-year-old Reagan Kendall, 37-year-old Kelly LaThorne, and 39-year-old Lisa Marie French. Those are believed to be Robert's victims because they all died under suspiciously similar circumstances when compared to the other five women he took from the world. In fact, in the case of Lisa Marie French, she was also a sex worker. In recent years, though, even prominent law enforcement officers have moved away from the idea that Robert may have killed more than the five victims he's known for, as there's not even enough evidence to suggest all of those women were killed by the same person, regardless of who it was. And the exact same thing has been said by law enforcement when people have put forward similar conspiracy theories, arguing that Robert was also the mysterious eastbound strangler responsible for murdering four women in Atlantic City in 2006. Then, as if that wasn't enough cold water thrown onto the fire of there being other murders carried out by Robert, the idea that Lisa Marie French was a victim of his was seriously hamstrung when serial predator Jerry Lee Williams later pleaded guilty in court to sexually assaulting and suffocating her himself. Sure, some will argue police were able to extract a false confession and that the real man responsible was actually Robert all along, but that seems like a stretch at this point. Still, it does present food for thought when it comes to the idea that we've yet to fully comprehend the magnitude of the damage he caused. After all, as the Orlando Sentinel noted in a 2010 article when discussing the wave of killings that had been happening there, quote, "According to the FBI, there are 28 murders in Florida that are unsolved and connected to serial killings that the Bureau suspects were committed by long-haul truckers. Those include 19 deaths along the Interstate 4 corridor between Tampa and Daytona Beach." But while again we must stress any connection Robert has to these deaths is purely theoretical, one thing that certainly wasn't theoretical was the fact that he had taken the lives of Laketa Gunther, Julie Green, Iwana Patton, Stacy Gage, and Rachel Bay. And that's why, once he was transferred over to county jail soon after his arrest, he was also charged with the murders of four of the five women. Namely Laketa, Julie, Iwana, and Rachel. Why not Stacy Gage too? Well, while police were confident they had their man when it came to that crime, there just wasn't enough concrete evidence to prove it. So perhaps worried it would harm their overall case if they included her death along with the other four victims, they chose not to seek a conviction for her. Needless to say then, that was a bitter pill for the Gage family to swallow, as it meant that even if Robert Hayes was convicted, they wouldn't be getting the full justice they wanted for their loved one. But even if that was the case, they were still able to take some solace in the fact that, now looking down the barrel of 4 first-degree murder charges, it was likely the Daytona Beach killer was going to be spending a long time behind bars. But first there would have to be a trial, which would be a death penalty case. Sure, for the defense, it was going to be particularly difficult as all the evidence appeared to point towards Robert's guilt. But even if it seemed like a given that their client was going to be sent to prison, they did at least hope they might be able to help him escape the death penalty, something that the prosecutor had by that point already confirmed he would be seeking. Part of the reason they felt so confident they could secure that was because, outside of the overwhelming DNA evidence found on at least 4 of the 5 bodies seeming to confirm the accused's guilt, they also had the first-hand account of a rare survivor of his wrath. That's right, in what must have come as a shock to Robert and his legal team, once the trial got started on February 11, 2022, the prosecution would reveal they had made contact with a woman whose name has not been made public about her own ordeal with the killer years before in 2005, and that she was willing to take the stand and testify that, during that period, Robert had also tried to kill her in a brutal attack. Luckily for her, though, she escaped the encounter with minimal physical damage. Still, the emotional scars remained, and now that she had an opportunity to help bring the person responsible down, she wanted to take it. Of course, the defense did everything they could to discredit the woman, as the way they saw it, there was only her word to go on that any such attack had ever taken place. And when it came to presenting a case against Robert's involvement in the other murders, they attempted to argue that the DNA evidence found at the scene didn't necessarily prove his guilt as it could have gotten there during a previous encounter. As they would try to frame things, it couldn't be ruled out that Robert had met Laquetta, Julie, and Iwana at a prior time and that this was how his DNA had ended up on their bodies. After all, they were all known sex workers and the accused had been very open about the fact he'd frequented such women in the past. Sure, it was a stretch, but the goal wasn't to outright prove Robert couldn't have been the man behind the murders. Rather, it was to simply create reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury. And if there was another viable reason for him to have come into contact with the deceased prior to them being murdered, then they hoped that that would be enough to seed that doubt. And that wasn't the only way they were attempting to create doubt within the minds of the jury either, as, when it came to the murder weapon, a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson Sigma Series VE, well, while the defendant did indeed own one of them, he'd reported it stolen from his vehicle in December of 2006. How convenient. Of course, that didn't mean he hadn't used it to kill the women, but again, it was all about providing some sense of doubt in the minds of the jury, because if the same weapon had been used to kill Stacy and later Rachel, two women he was not on trial for killing at that point, then how could it have been Robert who had done it? No, if it was indeed true that this weapon had been stolen, then the murders had to have been carried out by someone else. Or at least, that's the way the defense framed things. Again, when it comes to cases with circumstantial evidence, what the defense was saying was, Robert Hayes hired women to do sex work, leaving his DNA on them, and they all coincidentally were murdered by someone else afterwards. Not only that, but someone had stolen his gun and used it to murder these women. So either it was someone that Robert knew and wanted to make it look like he was a murderer, or it was this huge coincidence that someone had stolen his gun and killed women who he had just happened to hire for sex work previously. No. But wait, why was Robert Hayes not being tried for the murder of the final two victims? Well, because as mentioned earlier, in the case of Stacy Gage, there was not enough solid evidence to convict him. And in the case of Rachel Bay, that would actually be a separate trial that would come later. Still, even if he didn't have to worry about going away for what he'd done to those two women quite yet, Robert was still looking down the barrel of at least a lengthy prison sentence over the murders of his other three victims and at worst a lethal injection. Things continued to look worse and worse for him in that respect because the prosecution would not only continue to bring out further witnesses, but also family members of the deceased too. At one point, Laquetta's eldest daughter, Guyette Luster, would make a statement to the court where she told them her and her siblings had been robbed of the chance to grow old with their mother on account of Robert Hayes' actions. And as if that wasn't enough to create an added sense of outrage within the jury, Julie's sister Rhonda Owanski would also address the court and explain that the whole thing had been extra stressful on her on account of it happening at the same time her other sister was dealing with terminal cancer. Then, once they'd had a chance to say their piece, Dr. Anissa Ferris, the niece of Iwana, would continue by reading a prepared statement on behalf of her family in which she described the deceased as being a truly loving and caring person who always wanted to keep the peace. So, seemingly seeing the writing on the wall at that point, in the face of both the physical evidence building against the accused and the sympathy that had successfully been created for the victims in the eyes of the jury, the defense appeared to change tactics somewhat by arguing that even if his client was to be found guilty, he should still be spared the death penalty as there was no proof that what he had done was premeditated. As he would put it, in fact, if the murders had been planned out ahead of time, then a criminology major like Robert would have known to use a condom in order to prevent DNA evidence from being left behind. But he hadn't, and so, if he was guilty, then at the very least that could be considered an in-the-moment act. Certainly not a premeditated crime which would merit being put on death row. In fact, as far as he was concerned, the character of Robert wouldn't speak to him ever doing such a thing. Something his lawyer tried to get across by bringing in character witnesses of his own, such as an old friend of the accused named Letitia Cornelius. As she would state for the court, Robert had always been a very kind and loving man as far as she'd known him, especially when it came to being around women. So the news that he'd been charged with murder came as a complete shock to her because it was so far outside of the manner in which she'd expected him to behave. That's weird. Didn't people say the same thing about Ted Bundy? That was a sentiment which was also shared by numerous other friends and family members of Robert, with one even going as far as to describe an incident in which he'd stayed with a woman to make sure she was safe after a stranger had tried to beat down her door. So even if the DNA evidence found on the bodies at the time of their discovery was seen by the jury as proof that Robert had indeed killed them and not that he'd merely frequented them prior to their deaths, then something must have happened to make him lose his mind and kill in a brief moment of frenzy. Was it something to do with his childhood? That was a possibility the defense certainly wanted to get out there, as it was true that his father had been murdered when he was still a young boy and, on top of that, he'd also experienced sexual abuse during his younger years. As the defense would put it to the court, if it was indeed true he was guilty, then it was possible the murders were, quote, committed while under the influence of extreme emotional or mental disturbance. An individual who otherwise led a productive life, was well-liked, friendly and supportive of others, somehow, something goes haywire. Some triggers are fired up and he ends up having sex and, according to the state's argument, shooting and murdering these young women. What clearer evidence could there be of an extreme emotional or mental disturbance? Brain scans taken during Robert's time being held in custody not only apparently showed he had a past brain injury, but also that he was on the autism spectrum. Again, as the defense put it, his client was a good person overall. That said, it was possible his autistic spectrum disorder was triggered at various points and that it may have driven him to commit a crime. Of course, the prosecution would dismiss all of that as being nothing more than a futile attempt to have their client not pay for his crimes, as well as an insult to those who had autism, as there was no evidence to suggest such a condition inherently made people prone to violence. And that was exactly why they set about turning the tables on the defense by using their own testimony against them. By cross-examining those same friends and family members who had spoken so highly of Robert and arguing that their view of him as a smart, loving man who didn't display any signs of mental illness or impulsive behavior was only further evidence that what he had done had to have been premeditated. In fact, as they argued, no one who was acting in the spur of the moment would be aware enough to take someone away to a remote location before killing them. No, if it truly was a crime of passion, then they would have done it there and then. As it was put to the jury at that point, quote, "The victims are no longer with us. They're dead because of this guy right here. He made choices to kill them over a 3-month period. We're talking, he takes a gun out, he puts it to someone's head, and he shoots them. He thinks about what he is doing." And that argument, as well as all of the others that had been presented during the course of the trial, was something the jury would have to stew over now as, following closing statements being made soon thereafter, they were asked to confer with one another and come to a decision. Was the accused guilty or not guilty? And if he was guilty, did he deserve the death penalty? Well, unsurprisingly, it wouldn't take long for a decision to be made. In fact, it would only be 7 hours later that they returned with a verdict. And the verdict was that while, yes, they did indeed believe Robert Hayes was guilty on all counts of first-degree murder, he should be spared a death sentence and should instead spend the rest of his life in prison. Why had the death penalty not been given? Well, for it to be an option, all 12 jury members must agree on it as a punishment and, evidently, at least one of them had felt it was not the best path to go down. Obviously, that came as a relief to the killer because while he was still being convicted, he was at least going to be allowed to live, a luxury his victims no longer had. That was why he reportedly exhaled a sigh of relief in the courtroom as the decision was read out and Circuit Judge Raul Zambrano handed down 3 life sentences to be served consecutively without the possibility of parole, with that meaning that the Daytona Beach killer will likely die behind bars. But that's not the end of the story, though, because he's also still awaiting trial for the murder of Rachel Bay, with it likely being he'll also receive a guilty verdict for that case as well. And there remains a chance he'll get a death sentence for that crime, so he isn't quite safe yet. That said, even if he doesn't get put to death, at least some justice was served. And while it wasn't the result they wanted, it looks like it was enough for the prosecution as, in a statement made following the trial, they would tell the media, quote, "While the death penalty was not imposed, Hayes will no longer prey on the unsuspecting and vulnerable. He will die in our state prison system. There is justice in that." As for what this means for the use of genetic genealogy in helping to catch further killers in the future, well, it's just further proof that the technique works and that it's only going to become more commonplace as the years go on. After all, according to Lori Napolitano, it's already helped to solve around 70 cases of sexual assault and murder across the United States alone. So, as time goes on, hopefully it will become harder and harder to be a monster. If you're the victim of domestic abuse, please reach out to someone for help. Please talk to your local shelter or call the National Domestic Abuse Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233, or you can go to thehotline.org to chat with someone online. This website is set up so that, at any time, hitting the escape key twice will take you to a Google search page. That way, if your abuser is nearby, you won't get caught seeking help. If you're having feelings of harming yourself or someone else, or even just need someone to talk to, please contact your local mental health facility. Call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline by simply dialing 988 in the United States. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and will talk to you about any mental health issue you may be facing. If you are a member of the LGBTQ+ community and suffering from discrimination, depression, or are in need of any support, please contact the LGBT National Hotline at 1-888-843-4564 or go to lgbthotline.org. Thanks so much for letting me tell you this story. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on whatever platform you're on, hit like, rate us, or leave us a comment. You can check out our other show, Somewhere Sinister, on YouTube or anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, check out our merchandise at thisismonsters.com. The link is in the description. Thanks again, and be safe.